that's the geopolitical nature of it, isn't it? Obviously,
yes.
The US says, "Well, China's not one of our allies; they're essentially, you know, one of our opponents on the world stage, with a different view about
the way
things should be done." That's why they don't want them. They don't want their networks in countries, because there's always that risk, even though nothing's been proven.
If you want a massive, massive conspiracy theory, here's one that me and Paolo were talking about last night.
Hello and welcome to another telecoms.com podcast. Thanks, that's great.
Sorry.
Shall I just take it from the top?
Yeah.
Right. Hello and welcome to another telecoms.com podcast. I am joined as ever by Jamie and Ian, who's managed not to cough over the intro this time. Thanks, Ian. And just as a reminder that if you're watching this on the site or on YouTube or on Facebook, you can listen to it on SoundCloud and iTunes and vice versa. So this week we're going to chat about Huawei, because it just wouldn't be... Oh, actually, before we get into that, I'll say what we're going to chat about, but then there's something I want to mention as well. So we're going to chat about Huawei, we're going to chat about Nokia, and then we're going to chat a bit about sort of GDPR and all these sort of data regulations and all that sort of thing. But before we get into it, got a couple of things to mention. Apparently we're award winners. This is an award-winning podcast, AVA Digital Awards, which I've got to admit, I'd never heard of. But, you know, that doesn't mean I'm not happy about winning the award.
Yeah.
Thanks, AVA, whatever you stand for. Audiovisual
Awards, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh.
Must be.
I guess so, yeah.
Is it AVA something else?
I didn't take too much working out, did it? So there we are, and we're both audio and visual, so I guess we qualify.
Have you got a statue or something?
Yes, a little statue or a little
Oscar.
A little pod.
Do you want to thank anyone?
Yeah,
thank parents for
like a diploma.
I'd just like to thank my incredible team, without whom I'd be nothing. So hurrah for us, and also hurrah for us that we just had our inaugural telecoms.com drinks. What do we call it? The meetup? Is that what we call it, Jamie?
Yeah.
Jamie's VP of this.
Don't know.
No, he doesn't know. Okay, thanks, mate. Get back your phone, mate. Don't worry. And that basically just involves us buying a bunch of booze and getting a bunch of industry people together and drinking and talking, and that was all good fun. Were you feeling a bit hungover this morning? Were you all right, Jamie?
Yeah, wasn't exactly 100%, but
no.
it was okay. wasn't feeling too bad either.
You found that red wine exacerbates your hangover.
I've always really known it.
Did you mix the wines?
A bit, yeah, I think one thing I've taken away: we need to have a better supply of beer next time.
Oh.
It was heavy on the wine.
I'm surprised you skimped on the beer.
There was no lager.
It was just what they. It's just what they brought up. Yeah, there was hardly any lager as well. But on the whole, I thought it was really successful. And thanks
for
everyone who came along.
Did you get a lot of pale ale in?
There were some bottles of pale ale, but it was mainly. I mean, Ray organised it, and he really likes wine, so it sort of we went. It was heavy on the red and the white.
Did you go?
No.
And I'm not really. He doesn't really like food either. Apparently,
aside from hummus.
He doesn't like food.
aside from hummus.
God,
hummus and pita bread.
I hope Ray doesn't watch this one. We're slagging off his efforts. But it was really good fun. And if people are listening to the podcast and they're interested, get in touch. We're just doing it on an invite only basis, not because we're horrible elitists or snobs, but because we generally have a limited amount of space, so we can't just have everyone turning up. But, you know, if you're a regular pod listener and you want to know about it and get in touch, I'll hand you over to my VP of events and we'll take it from there.
Maybe you should do a world tour of the meetup.
Yeah.
Do it in different cities around the world.
The sort of colossal pub crawl.
Yeah. Oh my God.
The great telecoms pub crawl. How about that?
Sell it to BBC.
We'll get pissed in every country in the world on the local firewater.
It'll be like the grand tour.
Yeah.
Good opportunity to do one in Barcelona coming up.
Well, certainly, and we'll obviously be doing a pod from Barcelona. Did we have beers when we did the pod last year?
No, it was inside the studio.
Right, well, I think we need to work on that. Okay, anyway, so that's enough digression. The main thing, so Huawei, inevitably. The reason we talk about Huawei again, we've spoken loads of times on this pod and written articles going, you know, everyone's got it in for Huawei and they're saying how naughty they are and all that sort of thing, but where are the charges? Where's the proof? Well, now the US has finally gone all in.
And
come up with these charges. So the main, there were a total of 23 counts, weren't there?
But they kind of fall into two
categories. Two main categories, that's right. Yeah. So the main category, of which there were 13 counts, was one we sort of knew about already because it's related to their CFO getting arrested in Canada. And that was to do with them allegedly lying to US banks in order to cover up their dealings with Iran, which is on America's list.
Yeah.
And basically, if you do, as ZT found out, if you do work with Iran, then you're not doing work with America, is the long and short of it, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But, you know, so their problem, obviously...
Yeah, there's two ways that could hurt them, aren't there? Because they could, first of all, slap the CFO in with a jail sentence, potentially, for fraud, for sort of covering things up.
Which, bearing in mind, she's the daughter of the founders, has an extra twist to it.
Yeah, and they could if they do the same thing they did to ZTE, they could sort of prevent Huawei from getting access to US gear, basically.
Quite. So that would be bad. And so so they're charged firstly with just flouting those sanctions, and then they're charged with fraud to cover it up.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
So that's one chunk, and then the new one. But we sort of knew they sort of had indicated that was where they were going to go. But one that was completely new to me, although apparently this...
It's a few years old.
Yeah. Well, you can elaborate on that. Yeah. So I'll just do the charges, which was that Huawei basically nicked some technology off T-Mobile US.
Yeah.
And it was technology to do with testing handsets.
Yeah, some robotic system called Tappy, apparently.
It's not, Tappy the robot.
This isn't the big crux of the Huawei... witch hunts at the moment, though, is it? I mean,
those are the two main categories of cases that DOJ's unveiled.
But what they're basically telling people all around the world is that you shouldn't trust Huawei because the Chinese government has, is using it as a tool to
that's
spy.
Good point.
On
yeah, well, that's a separate thing.
The basis of, and for me, what it's been sold, it's been spun out of these two cases that look, Huawei. This proves everything we're actually saying, and you shouldn't trust Huawei because the government's really nasty. Mm. It's like, well, actually, that doesn't prove.
No, it's unrelated.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. That's a good point. The stuff that they're actually accusing them of doesn't necessarily infer that they're dodgy across the board.
It doesn't, although I think it's slightly related in that if their CFO, who's the daughter of the founder, is lying about stuff they've done, and the founder's standing there in front of reporters in Shenzhen saying, believe me, when the Chinese government makes requests, we don't go and give them information, which is what he did. It's harder to, they don't come across as a trustworthy company, do they?
So, and he's a former,
Well, there's that as well. I mean, that doesn't prove anything in itself. They're expecting everybody to kind of believe them and just take their word for it kind of thing.
And then there's never been any evidence shown.
Yeah. It's like the burden of proof's on them.
Or accused
kind of
doing dodgy stuff, not caught. I should hasten to add Huawei lawyers.
But the whole case against Meng just makes them look like slightly sort of devious types, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And I think
hang on a minute. If she's found guilty, that is, allegedly.
Just from now on, anything we say about Huawei's got the allegedly caveat on it. We're just discussing it, everyone. Just back off. Yes. So I think Jamie's point's good. But I think your point's also good that one thing doesn't prove the other. But if there is a general feeling of distrust... when you actually do have some concrete allegations, it only just serves to cement that feeling of distrust.
But I get where you're coming from, Ian, but I still don't think that it's a good enough point.
It doesn't prove the security side of things.
No, it doesn't. I mean, what's on the table at the moment is incredibly circumstantial evidence, and there's nothing to take the circumstantial evidence. If we're going to go down sort of like how you try people and sort of like the judicial route,
On the security issue.
You need more than what's circumstantial. But that is, I don't think you would even be allowed to use that sort of thing in courts because they just go, well, that's a gut feeling. Absolutely nothing. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I probably suspect the Chinese government are probably spying on people. And
so is everybody.
Yeah.
The US government.
And I strongly suspect that the US government are so sure that China is doing it because they know that they can do it as well. So I just think it's, until something is put on the table, I'm going to say, well,
that's the geopolitical nature of it, isn't it? Obviously,
yes.
The US says, well, China's not one of our allies. They're essentially one of our opponents on the world stage with a different view about the way things should be done. That's why They don't want them. They don't want their networks in countries because there's always that risk, even though nothing's been proven.
If you want,
that's what it basically boils down to.
If you want a massive, massive conspiracy theory, here's one that me and Paolo were talking about last night. So the reason
is Paolo going to thank you for going on the record.
No. I mean, this is my idea, but I mean, I don't truly believe it.
Right. Okay.
But the US has been very quick to ban Chinese companies, particularly Huawei and ZTE, from contributing to networks, and they've started deploying them really quickly. Now, what they've then done is plant the seed of doubt in the minds of other nations around the world, so more responsible nations and governments who have a better moral fibre will actually, instead of just immediately accusing and banning Huawei, they'll dither over the point. Certainty is, you know, the enemy of any procurement strategy in the telcos, so the telcos will stand back until a complete concrete solution,
which is unlikely to ever happen.
So the rollout of European 5G networks is slower, therefore the United States 5G network starts attracting R&D centres, then the products are made in the US.
Nice and convoluted.
And then all of a sudden, steps ahead. I said it was a conspiracy theory. But then they dominate 5G like they did 4G.
But that would be genius.
God.
Yeah, but the companies that are building all that 5G Machiavellian
stuff,
the European
swine
ones anyway.
That they are.
No. I don't mean from that perspective. No, I mean, I'm not talking about the networks. I'm talking about, you know, dominating the 4G digital economy happened in the US because they got 4G, the 4G experience better, quicker out in California. So you add that was like the perfect breeding grounds for companies like Uber, Facebook to really dominate and dominate the technology area over the last 4 or 5 years, and therefore position the US as a dominant feature, a dominant position on the worldwide technology stage.
Right,
You know, you create the tools. Doesn't matter who creates the networks.
Yeah,
but you give the people
on top. 5G gives rise to innovation. And
yes,
that's
more. I don't mean Nokia and Ericsson are going to dominate the world, but.
Well, that could certainly happen as a result. I don't know if there's a plan to make that happen.
Yeah.
But yeah,
it's a conspiracy theory. Yeah.
It certainly could happen. Yeah,
I think whoever's got the best network out there quicker is going to harbour innovation, and then
that's probably going to happen anyway because the European operators are kind of faffing around compared with the US ones.
But there's multiple reasons, and one of the reasons is because they don't want to buy off Huawei.
Well, there is that now.
Yeah, because what's the point in? I mean, this bloody thing about the European Union, about them amending.
Well, I was going to bring that up. So I don't know if you saw, there's a Reuters story this week about European Parliament trying to change some existing regulations, which are to do with critical infrastructure, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Which would class 5G networks as critical infrastructure. And then apparently vendors that are suspected even of having sort of links to, or it's basically Chinese companies that are suspected of having links to the government or that can be asked to supply information to the government aren't allowed to participate in critical infrastructure projects in Europe. So that would basically exclude
It's
Huawei
basically
from,
heightening the security requirements on procurement. And Germany are doing this, but they're writing it in such a manner that the security requirements are heightened to protect the government, but not so much that it excludes the Chinese companies from participating. So that's what I think Germany are trying to do. But then the European Union are just going a couple of steps further and saying if there's any possible... This is all
sounds a bit
sources.
Like the Australian statement when they banned Huawei from 5G.
This is all what sources.
They were basically going, no one can get involved in 5G who we think's a bit dodgy.
Yeah, and that's what the European stuff is like.
So basically they're trying to amend either... Now there's... What was it? It was the 2016 cybersecurity law.
Yeah, so that's the Chinese cybersecurity law. Apparently, there's a statement in that saying that any Chinese company or citizen has to cooperate with the Chinese government if we ask you to.
Yeah,
yeah.
And there's an actual. It's basically.
Well, it's a really hard defense when you're in a quite authoritarian country.
Yeah,
it's undemocratic. the ruling elite have a lot more power than they do in the West.
That's what this all boils down
to,
isn't it, really?
It's extremely hard to defend that. And I was just to sort of go back to, you know, what we're saying about these specific charges is they feel like they're a sort of crystallisation. So people, you know, within the telecoms industry, you've been in the telecoms industry longer than I, but there'd been, you know, people been sort of whispering about IP theft and reverse engineering and sort of dodgy business practices for a long time. And I think when you actually just come out, even if, as Jamie rightly says, the specific allegations are just the tip of the iceberg, they serve to sort of crystallize that whole feeling. And now, you know, Huawei is in this, what feels like an impossible position. Of, you know, I was just checking.
It doesn't help that they don't have a lot of friends. I think that's the issue, and it relates to those sort of IP thefts. But they're this company that's come out of the blue in the late 80s or whatever, and basically shaken up the whole sector. You know, Ericsson, Nokia used to have, well, along with a bunch of other vendors that have since disappeared or been acquired, partly because of Huawei, they used to have it all to themselves. And now Huawei is the biggest equipment vendor in the world. Kind of been perceived to undercut.
So there's a lot of people who, there's a lot of people who'd be pleased really to see like it.
One thing I would point out is, I mean, I know we're going back a little bit here, but I was just Googling it, where you were talking about that Chinese law. Don't forget, though, as well, that the Americans have the Patriot Act, which can force companies to do what they want. It is written towards terrorism, but I mean, I bet you any money, lawyers could argue that the text could also be extended to espionage as well. So they got the Patriot Act, which is essentially can force US companies to do whatever they want.
So it comes down to a sort of visceral distrust of China as a country to play fair. And it's obviously been, you know, it's been there for a while, but the Trump era has brought it into a sharper focus. It's probably been the signature sort of populist refrain of his, is we've got to do something about China and all that sort of thing. But what interests me about this week, and, you know, another manifestation of them actually bringing these charges, is how it now gets into the mainstream. So I subscribe to two weekly magazines, The Spectator and The Economist. I know you read The Economist. And so you read one of the leaders was this Huawei thing in The Economist. It was also the lead editorial in The Spectator. The Spectator normally writes about British politics. And yet their leader is talking about Huawei.
Well, I think just to finish the point off, she was on the BBC website. Yeah, the top stories.
It's just made it mainstream, and now Huawei is in the mainstream for all the wrong reasons.
If they sell more phones now.
They've been trying to raise their brand for years. Now they've done it.
Careful what you wish for.
And so, is this all these charges are separate from the Poland stuff?
Well, yeah, the charges against Meng Wanzhou in the US are not to do... The reason Poland is...
Oh, this is all to do with her?
Yeah, the Poland thing's different. So the Poland thing relates to the security issue because Poland says it found somebody who was basically spying, which is what the argument is for kind of... I mean, that's a more physical manifestation of it, I suppose,
in Poland,
cybersecurity.
The charges aren't levelled against Huawei. They're levelled against those two individuals.
Yes.
It just so happens that he's a Huawei employee.
Well, he's a Huawei employee, and Huawei have basically cut him loose.
It adds to the drip.
He's a rogue element.
The other one's also an Orange employee. You can sigh over there, you French bastard, but you're just as bad.
Steady.
It was a Polish guy, right?
Polish
Huawei
employee.
For Orange.
The other one was working for Orange.
But wasn't he Polish also?
There might have been Polish.
I don't know. I can't remember. I didn't read into it.
But the point is, every time a little story like that comes up, and you can bet there's a degree of effort to make sure that stories like this do gain prominence as well. You can imagine.
Yeah.
You know, all these little shadowy sort of agencies that try and sort of manipulate the public discourse behind the scenes. Every time one of those comes up, it just adds to it. One more person goes, right, yeah, well, that settles it. They're definitely dodgy. And it just feels like it's snowballing so much. And, you know, I stress, we always stress this. I'm not making a call one way or the other. I don't have any physical evidence of Huawei's guilt or innocence. What I'm commenting on is the momentum of its public image seems to be almost irretrievably negative.
But this is part of the problem. Something you just said there, which I think is a massive problem. And it's such a little nuance. But I think everyone has forgotten about this, is that you just said that you've got no proof of guilt or innocence. We're in a Western judicial system, and so is the USA, and so is Canada, and so is Germany,
innocent,
and so is France.
Yeah.
You never have to prove innocence. You're presumed innocent until
in a legal context.
Proven guilty. But you this is going to come down to a legal battle at some point. Mm.
And I don't know. It seems extra legal because countries are just going, nah, Huawei's out. And they're not apparently having to go through any legal process in order to do it.
Huawei's the Mel Gibson of telcos.
Right. Why is that? You're going to have to explain that analogy.
He's back though now, isn't he?
Yeah, he's back, but how many years later?
Oh, I see.
It's quite a long time later. Yeah,
but. Yeah, we're not gonna run with that analogy too much. Bear in mind what he got in trouble for. We'll just leave that there.
Wasn't cyber security.
I'm sick. Every week I get told off for saying something wrong on a podcast. I want to try and have a clean slate for once. cool. Okay. Yeah. I think we've explored that a fair bit. Just a little footnote, like stories that have been read a fair bit on telecoms.com about it this week. The Vodafone. We mentioned it on the podcast, but we actually wrote it up this week. A lot of people read the Vodafone stuff. There's the Europe stuff. And all these people just coming out with statements going, do you know what, at the very least, we're going to just put all our Huawei plans on hold. Mm. That would be interesting to see. I mean, it would be interesting to see. Actually, and the one that's been getting the most reads of all this week is one Jamie wrote at the start of the year about Huawei's just financials. And it's interesting. It's had a second bump that's even bigger than the first bump. So it's showing, I think, it indicates to me that people are suddenly really interested in its financials as well.
Yeah.
And I guess if we do a year-on-year comparison, I just can't imagine that this is going to be a great year for their numbers.
Well, because of all these markets being closed to them. Well, aren't they?
Yeah, and they're doing really well on smartphones, and there are obviously plenty of parts of the world that haven't put them on a show.
They're going all out on smartphones. Like, they're releasing three of... I don't even know what the flagship phone is.
Why don't we mention that, actually, Jamie, before we move on from Huawei? You wrote about the Foldy thing. What are your thoughts that they're going to launch? They're among a few companies who are going to launch a foldable smartphone at World Congress.
They haven't actually announced it.
They've teased it.
So it was essentially they put out a tweet, and
when?
Like an hour and a half ago.
Oh, right.
And the tweet looks like a foldable phone in the background.
It's like a V-shaped screen.
So they're essentially hinting, and they're saying, you know, keep an eye on for this massive innovation.
That'll probably be Sunday, will it?
Probably Sunday. No.
You mean in 2 weeks?
It's not 2 weeks.
On the Sunday.
Yeah, the day zero.
Yeah, it'll be on the Sunday.
Day zero is not 2 weeks' time.
No, it's in 3 weeks.
When
three
are you
weeks.
Going there?
Day zero is a carrier event, though.
He could be sending us messages. Where is everyone?
You're getting me worried.
Day zero is a carrier event, not a consumer event, though, isn't it?
It's all sorts, isn't
it? No, they've always done big consumer. LG's going to do a big smartphone launch on Sunday as well.
Yeah. But they're all basically going down this route. Samsung's apparently launching it before.
Well,
the
thing we looked at in the last podcast, the pictures that you showed, they look quite good. The prototypes.
Oh, no, that was Xiaomi.
If it's done well.
That was Xiaomi.
Well,
Xiaomi.
Whoever does it, if they're done on that.
Yeah,
factor,
Xiaomi,
then
LG, now Thingobob,
Motorola.
And you definitely expect
Motorola.
Samsung to be there, because Samsung are the people who make these bendy screens.
Yeah.
So you'd think they'd be all over it.
So basically, it's going to be quite big.
Damn sight more interesting than a 5G phone, anyway.
Do we think, Jamie, that. So, you know, one of the angles you took is, you know, is it more than just a gimmick? Have you got a verdict on that, or is it too early to tell?
Yeah, well, I mean, the problem is that, I mean, this is something
that... It
will
kill the tablet market.
Could do. I don't think the tablet market's necessary. Yeah, I mean, it's not, you know, taking over the world, the tablet market, has it?
No, a lot of people have got them. Just sales are down now, probably. But.
Yeah, but most people leave them at home. I got a tablet, but I barely ever use it. I think the foldable screen offers a good hybrid between a communications and an entertainment device. You know, because you can have the phone functionality, and then you fold it out, and then all of a sudden you've got the entertainment system functionality.
But I mean, until the angle of folding is really small, it's going to be a brick, and people don't want that.
But I think that's the idea, isn't it? To have it really small.
Yeah, but I think we're years away from that.
Oh, we don't. We
clearly,
haven't seen them,
like all of the prototypes now, they're massive.
Hang on, you haven't seen it yet?
Yeah, we haven't
seen
it.
3 weeks' time. You might need to get one. Yeah. Maybe.
Oh, you mean the Huawei one?
Oh, I mean anyone.
There's going to be a few probably, aren't
All
there?
Of the ones that we've seen so far, the angle is really
big. You've seen little promos.
He's referring to that one that we spoke about last week, that Xiaomi one.
Yeah, and the one that CES. There's another one.
That was old. So that's not one of the new ones that's coming out.
I think Pierre's got a point.
Just because Apple's not doing one.
No. But I mean, the Samsung one where they turn the lights off to show it, that looks like a brick, like a massive brick.
So the point is that we've got used to relatively thin. I mean, what is this? This is about a centimeter with the case on it.
Yeah.
And if suddenly we've got something that's a couple of... I mean, it's a first world problem, isn't it? It's like, oh my God, I've got such a thick smartphone. But, you know, all the stuff to do with smartphones is first world problems anyway. And it could be that if it's much thicker than this, it'll put people off. You're right. Okay.
I mean, the thing is, there's so many things that could go wrong with it. It could be
Well, quite.
You know, I mean, there's...
The software,
The software, I mean, this is something... So I asked... Ben... What's his name? From Ben Wood from CCS Insights sort of gave some comment for the story, and he highlighted that Android manufacturers are generally really poor at putting out good features first and foremost,
right?
Because there's such a rush to get across the finish line. There is, you know, they don't make it as high spec. They don't test for everything. It's always the second, third generation of these releases are always better. Which, and you know, this is why Apple is never first to market, unless it, you know, the only time Apple has really been first to market is with no keypad.
Yeah, the first. Yeah.
Everything else, it's usually 6 months behind, and I think it's because
or more.
Their loyalty is so high that they can make their customers wait.
Well, we were talking about this with Ray yesterday, and the thing is that they wait for the experience to be really worthy, and then they come out with the product.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the other thing to think about, is that, you know, if you've got these bloody big screens, and they're going to be different dimensions from what you used to,
it's a nightmare.
You know, who's actually got content that fits the dimensions of that screen, or, you know, that's who's got content that fits the experience that you're offering on the extended phone. You know, there's,
I think a lot of it from the experience point of view, then there's going to be a lot, to pick up on your point that you were quoting from Ben Wood, there's going to be a lot of pressure on Google with the next version of Android to have some very specific bits that take advantage of this ability to suddenly increase the screen real estate. Because, you know, Ben's completely right. It's got to a stage now where there's very little innovation over the top of Android. They tried it for a bit, but most people just think, you know, let's just give them straight up Android and all that. So, okay, well, that'll be interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing them. It's certainly the first time, almost since the modern smartphone was invented, that someone's trying something really different in terms of the actual form factor and that sort of thing. So that's interesting in and of itself. But I think it's quite possible. Normally, when you try something new like this, they'll come out and then go, oh, look, it's really great, and everyone's a bit like, ugh.
I think it would be really poor.
Right.
I think the idea is genuinely good, and I think it's more than a gimmick, because there is actually a use case for it. When you talk about, you know, people use tablets for entertainment systems when they're actually playing games. Games is becoming so really, really increasingly popular. More and more people are playing games on their phone now. Give them a bigger screen, maybe they'll do it.
What game were you playing earlier?
It's a really
Welsh rugby game.
No, it's a really old one. But do you remember 2048?
No. What is that?
Well, you scroll.
I know that's 2 to the power or something.
You scroll. You combine blocks, and you got to combine them all to get up to 2048. It's really hard.
Cool. You mentioned rugby. So by the time this goes out, the Wales game will have happened.
Who are Wales playing?
France. What's your prediction, Jamie? And we'll see if you're right
on
Monday.
Wales win by about 10.
By about 10. Low scoring or high scoring? Probably low scoring with the weather.
Low scoring with the weather it's going to be tonight.
So we're saying about sort of they win about 20-10.
I think he's
something like that.
Okay. Cool. Right. We better.
I think you're about right.
Yeah. Oh, yes. If I'm going to ask him, I should have asked you, but you've already answered it.
I don't know much, but I know we're not that great.
Do you follow the rugby much?
Not anymore.
Not a big thing.
No. It's from the north of France. Wrong bit.
It's a good point, isn't it?
But they play a lot of rugby in the north of France.
They're really into it around Perpignan, though, aren't they?
Well, that's not north. Yes. Bordeaux's quite south.
Not, but where's my housemate from?
Bordeaux's really south.
he's really north.
Brittany? Yeah. Not too far away of a drive from the big party town in Spain at the north.
Oh, you're thinking of Biarritz, are you?
No, I can't remember.
Again, that's still the south, though.
Yeah, well,
Spain,
the big hotbed
is
near. Yeah, it's the southwest of France, isn't it?
Yeah, you need to brush up.
Anyway, I was about to start a new thing, and we're going off on a tangent about French rugby regions, which is not strictly a telecoms topic. We are going to move on to Nokia. So Nokia's done their quarterlies. How did they do, Ian?
Yeah, quite well, I think. The fourth quarter performance was pretty good, because I think there was a bit of a worry about whether they'd managed to hit targets for the year, and they just kind of came in at the bottom end of them. And like, it wasn't unexpected. I mean, they guided for quite a strong end to the year, I think, on pickup in sort of 5G related business and other things, and the mobile network side of it seemed to do really well. Software stuff did really well. The enterprise side of things seems to be going quite strongly still. So
solid.
They had a solid quarter, but their share price still suffered, because they came out with this rather downbeat forecast for this year, where they'd previously been saying that their overall kind of addressable market was going to grow.
Yeah.
And they've now, after declining last year, they've now said it's basically unchanged this year.
Right.
And I think their share price was down sort of maybe 4 or 5%.
Right.
Yeah, in the afternoon anyway. I don't know if it's recovered since.
And
then,
that was an interesting thing about the narrative. And they said the pattern's going to be similar to this year in terms of soft
very
start.
Bad first quarter.
And then ramp
much.
Up. Yeah. And some of the logic in that didn't quite fly with me because they're saying it's all to do with 5G kit demand. But if 5G kit demand was ramping up in Q4, why is it suddenly falling off a cliff in Q1?
Yeah, well, they said there's two reasons. They said one's sort of staggered rollouts. Which basically means that the countries that are rolling out 5G quite aggressively, like the US, Korea, Japan, maybe China, they're not going to have 100% coverage anytime soon. It's going to be a slower pace of.
Yeah.
Your point's valid because surely they knew this, yeah?
Mm.
And the other point is related to kind of standards and technology issues.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, but go for it.
Where they're saying that. So Suri on a phone call really early in the morning kind of mentioned this when he got asked by Bloomberg. He was
right.
like, yeah, it's to do with basically the evolving ecosystem and
which we think is code for it's not ready yet.
Yeah. And then right. I spoke to the CFO on the phone and I said, what did he mean exactly? And he basically said, well, there's delays to the standard. There's still a lot of interoperability testing going on between chipset vendors and the network side. And that's basically... I mean, that's obviously led them to have to revise their forecast. So, and it's obviously come as a surprise to investors. Otherwise, the share price wouldn't have suffered.
And that interoperability stuff. So that was quite a good scoop by you.
It kind of ties in with because we were writing last year about this issue between, you know, the 5G standard keeps getting updated every 3 months.
Right.
And what came to light was that the specifications that came out in September wouldn't be backwards compatible with stuff that's based on March specifications.
Okay.
And the reason that's an issue is because it seems that some of the equipment vendors have already been shipping, you know, gear base stations and network gear based on the March specifications. So Huawei, for instance, which is talking about, I think, 25,000 5G base stations in the market now. I mean, it seems that a lot of them, if not all of them, are based on the March specifications.
And is it not just software upgradable?
They say that they're trying to do it through a firmware or a software upgrade. And I spoke to Qualcomm about this quite recently, actually.
And finally got through to him.
Yeah, I've been trying to get through to Qualcomm for a long time. They basically confirmed the problem.
Yeah, and so Qualcomm's relevant because they're, of course, the leader of the people who make the modems.
So two things that I wasn't absolutely clear on, which came out of that phone call, all of their silicon is going to be based on September or later specs.
Right.
And there is a backwards compatibility issue
with
network equipment. And the guy I spoke to from Qualcomm was a little surprised, actually, that companies were... I mean, maybe not surprised, but he said it's a bit odd that network gear has been, you know, deployed based on the March specifications because it should have been obvious to everybody that those wouldn't be that stable or robust. Operators, kit that's been deployed in the market, base stations that have already been deployed that are 5G ready.
Who said it's odd, did you say?
Qualcomm.
Oh, right, okay, fair.
Because he said it should have been obvious that this standard's not robust or stable at that stage. So that
strikes me as, like, I don't know, people just desperate to shift kit.
Well,
perhaps they sold it. I'm just speculating, but perhaps they sold it when, don't worry about it, you know, we can update it as an
opportunity to try and build market share and lock companies into their own sort of deals. And then I said to him, well, you know, he himself said he thought that it probably could be dealt with through a software upgrade. And he didn't know anything about that. I mean, he thought it could be, but he didn't have any visibility of that process or what was going on there. And that's certainly not something.
It all just comes over as a
certainly not something 3GPP supporting. That's for vendors to sort out.
Yes.
So, and clearly, this sort of stuff, you know, whether it is that specifically or whether it's the delay to the 3GPP standards process, which is only small. It's like a 3 month delay that came to light in around Christmas time.
That's 3 months, a fair bit at this stage.
Or whether it's other kind of. Issues that have happened because they've obviously tried to get this standard developed a lot more quickly than they normally do. It's been accelerated, the whole process. Whatever it is, it's obviously led Nokia to have to downgrade its outlook.
So that's what you're saying. So you think that is the main reason for the downgrade?
I think it's two things. That's what Suri said. He said there's two reasons for the downgrade. He specifically asked what the reasons for the downgrade. So there's two reasons. One is staggered rollouts, basically people just not rolling out as quickly.
And that seems like quite a generic cop out to me.
One is the technology ecosystem side of things.
Yeah, because the staggered rollout bit is basically saying we just hope people will get the quicker than they do.
I know when I wrote the interoperability story, you know, you're conscious of how big a deal is this? You know, is it something that can be resolved reasonably easily and it's not going to cause that much delay? But it's obviously led to a big fall in Nokia, big fall in Nokia's share price to some extent. If you make the
link, nailed it. Then,
well, I don't know about that.
Yes. So that is, and there was another thing. You and I went to a briefing with a company called InterDigital this week, and InterDigital, for people who don't know, they're involved a hell of a lot in the R&D and the intellectual property behind, like, the sort of radio interface and all the plumbing and all that.
Yeah,
all that
we
really.
We were at their booth in Mobile Congress.
Yes, yeah, we were. Are we going to be there again?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, I actually had a look at on the internet before we came up here.
Okay.
Because we were having a little chat downstairs about patents, and it's funny because the companies that are listed as known to sort of own 5G standards essential patents, as they call them, InterDigital comes up in that list.
It's right up there.
And it's obviously not a name that's known in the way that Nokia and Huawei and Ericsson and all that.
So they were giving us a presentation about this, that and the other, but one thing I took away, you know, their CEO was there. One vibe he was giving, part of his presentation was anticipating World War Congress, and the general vibe I got from him is that he thinks 5G is going to be a bit of anticlimax at this World War Congress, in so much as, you know, we've taken the piss for several years because everyone bangs on about it and overhypes it.
Yeah.
But this is the year where it's actually supposed to exist substantially.
Yeah.
But I think there's still going to be a fair bit of overpromising and under-delivering on that front, and he seems to agree.
Yeah, he was sort of saying it's getting ahead of itself a bit, though, wasn't he? Because although, you know, 5G was cracked up to be this radically new type of connectivity solution that would open up all these new service opportunities to do with things like low-latency communications and massive IoT.
Yeah.
And actually, all we've really done at the moment is provide a faster connectivity
more bandwidth
technology.
And in fact, we've got this 3GPP Release 16.
Release 16 is where a lot of those changes
where a lot of that's
happened.
And that's not going to happen until December, is it?
I think, in about a year's time. Yeah, I think maybe even next year, is it?
I think on the little roadmap.
Locked down maybe at the end of the year.
Right.
And then, but certainly, you're probably not looking into. I mean, I asked Qualcomm about that. When do you expect to see services based on Release 16 in commercial use? And he was. I mean, I think he's kind of optimistic about this, but he was sort of saying 2021, 2022.
Yeah.
That seems quite aggressive to me, because the other problem is I don't think a lot of these, it's not just the technology, it's whether the companies are ready to start using.
Quite.
Or whether the service ideas have been developed. And all people ever seem to talk about is autonomous cars and...
Robotic surgery,
that's it.
The connected... Autonomous 5G ambulance.
There are some others, but
didn't we on the previous pod talk about a car that can put you back together after you have a crash?
Yeah.
So anyway, yes. No, I think that is a good point. And so we're stuck. We're actually going to be stuck for the next couple of years or so with just trying to find business use cases based on enhanced mobile broadband.
Yeah.
Which it by itself, given that LTE keeps increasing its bandwidth, doesn't it?
Yep.
You know, we get LTE Advanced and we've got. Thankfully, we're not doing the sort of 4.9 recurring G thing that we used to do before. That used to get annoying. Although, of course, we had AT&T's silly LTE Evolution.
I know
5G Evolution. 5G,
well, they're using that now. They're actually using it, aren't they?
Which is just basically LTEA, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, but I think the fact that LTE's probably provides pretty decent bandwidth for most needs is going to mean they're really going to struggle. People are going to go, oh, it's great, you can stream 4K video and all that sort of thing. How many people is that a pain point?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's in the operator's interest to use 5G technology rather than LTE Advanced, simply because it's a bit better. Yeah?
Right.
It's a bit more efficient. There might be some cost benefit. It's better equipped. It's newer equipment.
But selling 5G to consumers.
But well, I think you'll get those consumers, and certainly in the American market, I think
early
people
adopters
will go out and buy phones because they're 5G phones. I think they seem to get off on that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any 4K display.
And maybe that'll bump. Maybe that will provide some bump for operators' revenues, because usually you can charge early adopters a bit more.
Maybe the foldy phones. Maybe that'll be it. When you've got a foldy phone, you need more bandwidth to stream a video on it.
Yeah, maybe.
Imagine if you had a 5G foldy phone. You'd just
download
the
movie.
The talk of the town.
Maybe foldy phones will be 5G as well.
Well, yes. Or at least they'll call themselves 5G. And we will be duty bound to
imagine
take a piss
the battery life
overreach.
On those.
Yes.
2 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
Just drained.
Cool. Okay. So I think we've done that one. So there's one more topic I wanted to bring up. Something that's got a fair bit of traffic this week is another thing Jamie wrote. Complete tangent, talking about GDPR, which in case people have forgotten, is a sort of European piece of regulation about sort of data protection, data privacy and all that sort of thing. So Jamie, before I completely ruin the story, why don't you tell us what that story's about and why we should care?
It's because the first court cases are coming
right.
out. So it came through, what was it, 25th of May last year, GDPR was enforced. And basically,
just remind me, I actually need a recap. What is the point of it? What did it do that wasn't in place before?
So it's the General Data Protection Regulation.
Okay.
And it's quite a broad brush approach to tighten up data privacy,
right.
The retention, collection, and use of data,
right.
And also how much you and sort of like put more stringent penalties in place,
right.
to ensure that the big technology companies
adhere
are
to.
Actually bothered about the regulations.
Which brings us to your
yeah.
people are actually getting
so
now.
It got put in place on 25th of May last year, and within hours of, you know, like 9 o'clock in the morning, you had some privacy advocates filing their complaints. And over the last couple of weeks, you've started to see the first rulings and sort of progress in these cases come into the public domain. The big one was over in France, where you had, I don't know what their regulator is actually called, but the acronym is CNIL.
Okay.
CNIL.
Yeah, you're thinking of RCEP probably, aren't you?
That's Italy.
That's AGCOM.
Yeah,
you're thinking of
the
telecom regulator.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, which is
worry.
Different. Yeah.
So the data protection regulator is CNIL, and they fined Google $50 million, which, you know, can be paid off in a matter of minutes by
yeah.
Google.
Just find that down the back of the sofa.
For the way they collect consents, they were being too vague, but then also making it too difficult for users to actually find out how the data was being used, who it was being passed on to, and how long it was being retained for. So basically, they've been too vague up front, and then they were creating too much of a red tape maze for accessibility for further information. So they've had a fine. They're appealing against this fine just basically because it completely undermines their business model, but also it undermines the whole concept of the sort of the digital economy and the app economy. Like, for instance, terms of service, if you disrupt terms of service and collection of consent, the entire app economy on Google Play
yeah.
and App Store falls to pieces because none of these apps are equipped to deal with GDPR consent.
Yeah.
So that's one of the cases. And there's so many cases emerging. And I think this is what's really caught Silicon Valley. Well, maybe not caught them by surprise, but it's caught a lot of people by surprise. The sheer breadth and variety of lawsuits that are being brought
right.
to the courts.
This is all
at the
in
moment.
The last few days.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you've
it
got,
only came into force.
Oh no, no, in the last couple of months. But this is where
right.
you're starting to
come
get.
To a head.
When did it get introduced? GDPR. When did it actually?
25th of May, 2018.
Right.
But obviously,
you said that about eight times.
Right? Yeah, I know.
But
just,
because
you know,
but because this is new regulation and new legislation, it takes a long
right.
time
yeah,
for
yeah.
the actual for the courts to understand what the precedent should actually be and how you rule on
yeah,
specific
yeah.
and sort of whether companies have actually violated or they've been non-compliant. And there's, I mean, it's such a complicated document because you can be non-compliant, but as long as you can prove that you try to be compliant, you can
right.
get away without
I
a
see.
Fine. So there's loads.
They're trying to give people a chance to get their act together.
And there's also other things, like you don't have to collect consents as long as you can prove there's a genuine business interest or genuine interest in putting this information
yeah.
and collecting data.
Yeah.
So there's so many loopholes in it. It's a nightmare.
It's interesting that there's a bunch of stuff happening. So I wrote a little story, which funnily enough got shared by UKIP. We got some clicks out of UKIP. And that was to do with this Article 13 thing, which is to do with sort of copyright. Article 11 and Article 13 are these two quite contentious things to do with copyright and linking and using copyright material and all that sort of thing. And, you know, the people who are anti it say it breaks the internet. And it all comes under, to me, the general heading. And there's other stuff, like you wrote another thing about Facebook, how they keep getting into trouble for this, that and the other. I'm just getting a general sense that we've got to the stage with the internet, especially with regarding data and with social media and with, you know, how when and privacy and how much control you have over the collection of data that concerns you. We've also been making up as we go along, because the more you think about it, the more you realise that we were not culturally, legally, politically ready for the internet. I mean, think about it. Over the entire history of mankind, there's nothing like it. It's completely unprecedented.
Yeah.
And suddenly, you know, look at social media. Even, you know, let's say a generation or so ago, the closest you get to social media might be, you know, might be speaking on a forum on the internet. Or then before the internet, what would be the closest you get to social media? You know, just being in a room with a bunch of people. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and now suddenly we can say something, like you see all these people getting in trouble on Twitter, you can say something and you're speaking to the entire world, potentially.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that's been bounced around for ages, and that the idea that technology works 100 times faster than regulation. And,
yeah.
And I mean, yeah. what you've got at the moment, and I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, but there will be an overcompensation, and it's that... You know, the internet players have had such free reign over the last couple of years. And you've always got to remember that I always try to relate it back to the growth of a human or the aging of a human. These technology companies are teenagers.
Yeah.
They're pushing the boundaries. They're being rebellious teenagers
and big trust fund.
Well, they're trying to find out how much they can get away with.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what teenagers do, because they don't know the rules, and a first-time parent, you know, when you were a first-time parent, you didn't know what you were doing with the kids, but you sort of made it up as you go along. And you know, that's exactly what the regulators are trying to do now.
I think that's a good analogy.
And this is obviously why, you know, people often say that the first kid is often, you know, you're strictest with the first kids more than your second and third one, because you overcompensate and then you learn from your mistakes. And I think that's exactly what the European Commission is trying to do at the moment. So they're trying to wrestle back control and put regulations in place, but they're overcompensating.
I think you're completely right, and I think they won't be the only ones, because there's just so many other things, you know, like my little bugbear about things like censorship and, you know, that Patreon thing that I got, that Jordan Peterson shared, that got me a nice lot of traffic. You know, that's, again, an indication that Silicon Valley doesn't really know what it's doing. So these social media companies are I actually have some sympathy for them. Just give me one sec.
I disagree with that.
Okay, well, I'll quickly finish my point and then you can fundamentally disagree. The social media companies are in a difficult position because they're under increasing pressure to be sort of moral arbiters and actually to take down the wrong kind of content. But obviously their algorithms can't keep up with it and all that sort of thing. And so they end up making decisions which, in my opinion, are sometimes biased by their own prejudices. And in the case of Patreon, in my opinion, they take down certain people like Sargon of Akkad because he's not to their taste, rather than because of some absolute system of weights and measures. But I do also understand that they're under pressure to do something, so I'm not totally unsympathetic. What was the thing that you disagreed with?
So to say that they don't know what they're doing, I think making it up, I don't think you should link making it up as you go along with don't know what they're doing, because yes, I 100% agree with you, they're making it up as they go along, but purely because they're exploring areas of the internet and business models which don't exist.
So this is the
one thing that I find a little bit... I do agree that that sometimes the internet players need to be punished, but I find it a little bit tough to swallow that they're punishing them for things that they did 4 or 5 years ago. Because when you're exploring new ideas and you're exploring new business models, you don't know where the line is for right and wrong. And the only reason you know where the line is for right and wrong is through experience. Now, basically, they're punishing them for exploring and trying to innovate. So basically, these bureaucrats are saying, don't do new things, otherwise we're going to slap your wrist.
Wow.
Or if you are going to do new things, make sure you get it 100% right the first time, which is impossible.
Well,
I mean,
I completely agree with you that retrospective application of new laws or regulations is bull.
Oh, it's but, yes.
And it happens. You know, it happens like with tax. I've got mates who've had a nightmare. There's been a new tax law that's come along that's made some little bit of accounting they did 10 years ago suddenly dodgy, and they'll retrospectively go after them. It's absolutely tyrannical.
Yeah, you can't say it because at the time.
Yeah, at the time you did it in good faith. You thought your account went, this is a perfectly legitimate dodge.
I mean, I just think they're disincentivising, especially with these retrospective punishments, because hindsight is always 20/20.
Quite.
They're disincentivising exploration of murky corners and unknowns, which is a horrible, horrible precedent to set.
So the only thing I'd say so retrospective we agree, but going forward, I mean, as long as there's transparency, as long as they say, Facebook, if you in any way sell on someone's data without their explicit consent, you're in trouble from now on, then Facebook knows where they stand, and they know that that's a particular business avenue that they shouldn't pursue if they don't want to deal with these repercussions. But it's the vagueness and the sort of the constantly evolving nature of it, which I think, where I do agree with you, where that's harmful to innovation.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's always the fact that these are very well-resourced companies that they're having a go at. So they've got tons of lawyers. So I guess they can protect themselves, even if they do push their luck every now and then.
I mean, this is... I don't know. I mean, the big question you've got to say is, how many lawyers do you hire? Because, you know, over the last couple of days, the GDPR stuff that's come out is the original one. There's this one about sort of collecting consent. So it's fighting, you know, that's one specialist case one way. And then Max Schrems has brought up another case about right to access. So that's collecting, that's fighting legal battery, and that's another specialism. And then there's another one which is about how a marketing agency has been brought in and has a complaint against it, IAB, on the grounds of these ad sort of marketplaces.
Right, yeah.
So they're technically saying that that's a violation of GDPR now. And I didn't even take it that into consideration at the time, months ago.
Yeah.
And there's so many more of these different areas. I mean, this is such a such a wide net that they're casting.
They're trying to some extent, shut the stable door after the horse has bolted. They're trying to reclaim control quite a few years after there was no control at all.
They're trying to claw it back, but you know, it's an impossible job. I've got a lot, although I often talk negatively about regulators and bureaucrats in general.
Boresome bureaucrats.
Yeah.
And what do you call them? The boresome bureaucrats of Brussels.
Yeah.
I quite like that.
Oh, there's loads. I went into, there was the Brussels brunch brigade.
Oh yeah,
there's loads of them I went into.
I'm pleased you've
lethargic legislators.
I'm pleased you've picked up on my diss about them constantly being at lunch. I quite like that caricature of bureaucrats.
But you've got to have some sympathy for them, even though I think a lot of them are sort of like, well, they do it for the pension and to hide away and do little work.
Mm-hmm. And have long lunches.
Yeah, and have long lunches, because they're trying to legislate and put rules on such a massive amount of things.
Yeah.
And it's not just, you know, technology has about 20 different or 500 different branches. So they've got to legislate all the individual different branches. And then they've got to do it for all the different market segments for specific applications. But then that's just technology. Then you've got to go into, they've got to do it for fisheries. They've got to do it for bloody textiles. You know, there's so much to do.
I've got a lot of sympathy for them, probably more than you two.
For the tech players?
I think for regulators in the tech industry and regulators in telecom as well, who always get a bad rap. Because they're a very easy target.
Yeah.
And everybody loves to moan about them, but they actually serve quite an
important
role.
I've got to plead guilty.
If you go to countries where regulators are really deficient, then you've already got problems in the market usually.
Yes.
Where there's like a massive monopoly somewhere, like in Mexico, for instance.
Yeah. And no one thinks we don't need regulators.
Yeah.
Or at least no sensible
need them,
person.
And therefore, they're not just people, you know, sitting around like who are a waste of space, and we could just get rid of them all and let's kind of move on and forget about regulation. So,
it's a fine balance to strike, and I think the US are, well, under Pi, I think they're going too far one way, too far light touch,
too laissez-faire,
and then In Europe, the European Commission seems to want to go too far the other way and put too much red tape around things. Yeah, yeah. So there's a fine balance to strike.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone is... I mean, it's a very, very immensely difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, finding that balance is incredibly, incredibly difficult. But I don't think anyone's nailed it.
But I think, you know, you appreciate the difficulties. I mean, you two actually went out, I think, at one time with Ofcom, and had some dinner with them because you'd been writing on an issue and they took you out and went, well, hang on a minute, but this is what happens. There's always a legal challenge. There's another legal challenge. And you don't see
that. We had some sympathy for that.
You don't see that in the press or in the statements that come out from companies. You just hear about operators going, oh, Ofcom's done this, and it's
I think this might have been a time when I was being particularly scathing about how long it takes them to do stuff, and that was part of the explanation: is that we've got to dot all the I's and cross all the T's, or it's just gonna get swamped in litigation or whatever. Cool. I think we've done about an hour, haven't we? So we should probably wrap it up there. So thank you very much for watching/listening, and see you for the next one.